I'm delighted to have in the studio today Professor Ross Klein from Canada and Steve Gratian, who is the president of the Save Our Spit Association on the Gold Coast. Now, Professor Klein is one of the world's foremost authorities on the cruise liner industry and, of course, of ports. Steve Gratian and his organisation fight hard to preserve the spit for the public and also to ensure the facts are there with any proposed cruise liner terminal. We recognise that many of our listeners, enjoy cruising, but today's chat with these gentlemen is more about what a cruise liner terminal might mean for the Gold Coast and indeed for Brisbane. So welcome, gentlemen. You're most welcome here at 4CRB.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Steve, you know Ross pretty well. And I'm just wondering why he's here again.
Well, I've known Ross for over a decade. We first invited Ross to come to the Gold Coast when he was visiting Australia in 2006 to come up and have a look at our situation with the Peter Beattie-inspired cruise ship terminal at the end of Doug Jennings Park, which we felt would devastate world-class dive sites, access to surf beaches, and take away part of Doug Jennings' legacy, which was to preserve the spit in perpetuity as public open space. So knowing that Ross was doing a lot of research into the economics and environmental and safety of cruise industry around the world, we asked him to speak at a public information meeting, and also we had a big rally organised as a sort of final thrust to let the government of the day know that the people weren't happy with their public beaches and waterways being given over to a huge cruise industry. And that was the first time we met Ross. He was very effective because within a few days of him being here and giving his information, the Beattie government dropped that cruise ship proposal. And then in 2014, likewise, he was going to be in the Southern Hemisphere, and we asked him to do the same. We had a business breakfast where he met tourism operators, families, business people, recreational users. And once again, his information and knowledge seemed to give greater advice as to why the spit and the broadwater should be preserved as an economic and environmental and social asset for the Gold Coast. So it's an ongoing relationship, and Ross got in touch with us, and it was a break in his academic and teaching at the University in Canada, and wanted to come to a warmer southern clime and chose the Gold Coast. And he said, I'll be visiting. Is there any way you can put me to use with your campaign? Because he follows it from afar through social media. We said, absolutely, we're at the height of a battle at the moment, and it will be great because, as Socrates says, democracy only works when the public are informed and knowledgeable, and who better than Ross to inform us and give us knowledge about the vagaries and the details of the cruise ship industry.
So, Ross, given that we're going to deal in facts, and given that you spend a lot of time researching the cruise liner industry, and I note too on one of your websites you refer to yourself as a cruise junkie. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, the website started, cruisejunkie.com. I started that in 2002, actually for two reasons. I just published my first book, and how do you publicize a book other than getting it out on the web? So I used the website both for providing information but also to let people know a book was available. The other thing I used the website for was that in doing my research, I'd accumulated lots of data, things like people overboard, things like environmental offenses, accidents at sea. And I decided, well, why am I holding on to this data in a private place that no one sees? I decided to make all of that public. So I put online a comprehensive list of people overboard, of fires, of ships that have sunk, and so on. And it's been interesting because not long ago I testified in the U.S. Senate and I presented my data on people overboard. The industry tried to say, well, that data is not correct. You know, we don't like that. And, of course, the chairman of the committee said, well, do you have data that we can use instead of that? Well, no, we don't keep track of those things. So the only data anywhere in the world of people overboard is on my website.
And this would apply to all sorts of interesting facts and data with respect to cruise liners. And I noticed, again, reading through, that it also includes sexual abuse of children. crime on board ship, and all the problems that occur with that. And we were talking earlier about what law applies on a cruise liner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I guess there's two issues here. One is cruise lines like to promote themselves as virtually safe. Bring your children on board and don't worry about it. And, of course, that's good for business. It's bad for business if it gets out that there are things like crime, including sexual assaults of children. The data that we have is that the rate of sexual assault on a Carnival Cruise Line ship is 50% higher than the rate of sexual assault on land in Canada. Over 34% of the victims are under the age of 18. Now, that's information the cruise line doesn't want out there. The industry doesn't want out there because it's not good for business. You can't tell people to bring your children on board and it's safe and then have that out there. Now, the difficulty is that these ships are operating often in international waters. So there is no law that applies. The law that applies is the law of the country that flags the ship. So if the ship is registered in Panama and the ship is in the Philippines or is in the Indian Ocean, it's the Panamanian government that is responsible for investigation and prosecution. It's not going to happen.
So a cruise liner terminal docks on the Gold Coast, and there's been a crime on board. It's up to the person on the ship to report it to local police.
Right.
Who then investigates that crime?
That would normally depend on the local jurisdiction or the national jurisdiction. I know in the U.S., if the crime occurred while the ship was in port, it would be the city police. If it occurred in the state waters but not the city waters, it would be the state police. But if it happened outside of those state waters, the U.S. has legislation that gives the FBI jurisdiction of any crime against a U.S. citizen anywhere in the world. So the FBI, the national police, would be responsible. Now, that legislation of coverage of any crime in the world of a citizen is unique to the U.S. We tried getting the Canadian government to introduce that legislation, and they said, we're not really interested in protecting Canadian citizens outside of Canadian waters. And I believe the Australian government, even though they have had their commission of inquiry, I think the Senate had a commission of inquiry around crime, there's still no legislation that protects Australian citizens when they're traveling, including on a cruise ship, outside of Australia.
So our purpose today is not necessarily to denigrate the cruise liner industry. And I know, having spoken to you, that that's not your aim either. But some of these other tangential issues are things that we're not hearing about from our local Gold Coast City Council. And I think because it's ratepayers' money that's being spent, I think we should hear the whole story, and perhaps you can play a role and SOS can play a role in putting that fact forward.
And actually, if I can say, the reason why crime is relevant here is not that I'm trying to muckrake and, you know, don't go on a cruise because of crime. The reason why it's relevant in terms of a city such as Gold Coast building a terminal is if a crime is occurring when the ship is at the terminal or near the terminal, it's the responsibility of local police to do that investigation. The question is whether or not Gold Coast is going to be prepared to hear those complaints, to send a team to do those investigations.
Quite so. So on the basis that the Gold Coast City Council is driving hard to get a cruise liner terminal here, and having one inside in the shallow Broadwater appears as being defeated. Now the proposal is to have one off the coast on a very long jetty. How do you see that? Are there any parallels elsewhere in the world with that?
Well, I think the only parallel that I know of is the one that the mayor has pointed out. He says that this one is like the pier and jetty at Costa Maya in Mexico. And the design, as visually, is very much the same. The difference is that Costa Maya is a sheltered bay. It's in the Caribbean, and it's relatively sheltered from sea conditions and from winds. The jetty and terminal being built here is going out into the Pacific Ocean. It's not protected. I think it becomes a real question as to whether or not that type of structure will have the integrity to remain standing through monsoons, through various weather conditions, and with a ship that's, you know, tons of weight that also captures the wind, is it going to be able to withstand that kind of pressure? And I think those are the questions which they'll do feasibility studies, but we're not going to know until you know, a ship stopped there, whether or not it works. There was a ship not too long ago in Ketchikan, Alaska, misjudged as it was pulling up to the pier. And this is in a sheltered area, wiped out the entire pier. It's gone.
My goodness. And so assuming that this went ahead, could people join the ship and continue on a cruise here, or could others leave the cruise at that point?
I don't think they can. The issue that we've always found here is that the government doesn't quite appreciate the difference between what's called a home port ship and a transit ship. The difference being a home port ship starts and ends a cruise in that place. Gold Coast is not going to be a home port. So you cannot get onto a ship that uses a place as a port of call. A port of call is after you leave the home port are places you stop along the way. So if one wanted to come to Gold Coast as a port of call, you'd have to go to where the ship began, Brisbane, Sydney, someplace else. So the only visitors will be people who get off the ship that have gotten on somewhere else. And the only people getting on the ship are those people who got off when the ship arrived.
So the primary port in this case would be the new proposed port in Brisbane.
Yeah, it would be Brisbane if they're going from the north, or Sydney if they're coming from the south. But there the question is, why would a ship starting in Brisbane that's doing an itinerary to New Zealand and to the South Pacific make a stop in Gold Coast? Mm-hmm. What is the value? Why would they head north up the channel to then come south to go then back north to the South Pacific? It doesn't make sense. And, of course, what value? Cruise lines make decisions on, are they going to make more money in the port than they do on land? And I'm not too sure whether Gold Coast can provide that, and whether there's high passenger satisfaction. What I understand as this plan, with all of its intricacies, is not going to lead to high level of passenger satisfaction.
Now, our council here, I believe, are running on the basis of build it and they will come. Mm-hmm. Is that a premise that you would endorse?
I think Townsville was the last place on the Queensland coast to try that, and I think their terminal is dead in the water. They spent a lot of money, but nothing's happened. Mm. We can look outside of Australia. In British Columbia, in Canada, at the point at which ports were thinking, well, gee, if we build them, they're going to come, and three ports built new terminals, Prince Rupert, Nanaimo, and Campbell River. Each of those is either underutilized or not utilized at all. All the business went to Victoria, which expanded its port. So, yes, they had all the ships that they were anticipating, and Victoria gets 233 ships with almost 600,000 passengers, and those other three ports combined, maybe they get a dozen ships and maybe about 3,000, 4,000 passengers.
And let me ask you, has the Gold Coast City Council sought your advice?
I've never been contacted directly by anybody on the Gold Coast City Council or anyone involved in the proposals around cruise tourism. I've been contacted certainly by Save Our Spit Association, and I've had conversations as a result of Save Our Spit's invitations for people to meet with me. I've had conversations with the Coastal Water Authority and with various kind of third-party quasi-governmental organizations. But no, I've never been consulted or never been asked for my opinion or advice by anybody in the city council.
So it might be a good moment to suggest that councillors listening to this broadcast might contact you while you're here to set up a connection so that they can hear the facts, warts and all, for themselves, the good aspects and the poor,
yes,
and hopefully to integrate some of that into the $800,000 they're going to spend on looking into this project, $800,000 yes, of ratepayers' money. Should that get the job done, by the way, $800,000?
Well, this is only a feasibility study as to whether or not this idea of putting a jetty a kilometer out to sea is even feasible. If the feasibility study says that it's feasible, and we know generally consultants take money and say, well, what do you want me to say? So we're likely to get a report that's going to say it's feasible. Then they're going to spend up to $100 million, and that's based on estimates today. By the time it's done, it's probably going to be more, $100 million to actually build this jetty that ships are going to stop at. And that's not even dealing with infrastructure on land. So are ratepayers willing to see their government spend $100, $150 million of their money on something that isn't even assured that's going to have any business?
Well, this ratepayer isn't, I can tell you. I don't have any particular dislike of cruise liners, but I don't think it stacks up, and I personally don't believe it should have ingress and egress on the spit for all the reasons that Steve Gration would support. But having said that, if the council goes about looking into this in a proper professional way, then I'd be satisfied. My concern is the very thing you raised, and that is you pay consultants and you get the answers you want. So I am sceptical, if not a touch cynical.
Yes.
Having said that, you'd be available for consultation if required.
Oh, most definitely. And I'm paid a very handsome salary in my job at the university. I'm not selling myself as a consultant. I've already done the work. I have the intelligence. I'm more than willing to share what I know to anybody without any expectation of remuneration. That's
not
my goal.
So you would provide that data to the Gold Coast City Council free of charge?
Oh, of course. It's not an issue. I mean, as an academic, 40% of my salary is to do research. And the expectation of doing research is that you disseminate your research. The idea of being asked to share this material is dissemination. I'm doing what I'm being paid to do by the university. So it would really be kind of unethical for me then to say to them, well, give me some more money because I'm going to do what I'm already being paid to do.
So it's also true to say you don't have any conflict of interest with cruise liner terminals and the cruise liner industry, do you?
Not in the least. Not in the least. And I think what's unfortunate is that often ports will listen to the cruise lines, to the cruise lines authorities, and when they ask for more information, the cruise industry tells them who to talk to. And they're specifically told not to talk to me because they don't want that kind of data. They only want the positive side of the industry. And it's not a matter that I would say negative things that the industry shouldn't be here. What I would do is give information so that the port or the community can protect itself from the exploitation that is commonly done by the industry in other places.
Well, let's talk about the positives that could flow from this on the basis that Brisbane is what's the correct phrase, a terminal port, is it, or a main port?
A home port.
A home port.
Yes.
And how can benefits flow from people arriving and leaving in Brisbane? Do we get some benefit on the Gold Coast?
I think that there's great potential. And just to put this into perspective, in 2015, Brisbane had 108 home-ported ships. Okay. Now, the question is, well, how does that have value to Gold Coast? Well, I think the most obvious one is cruises offer pre- and post-cruise packages. You pay an amount of money for a night or two someplace else. Well, that's perfect for Gold Coast. You market a package where people come to Brisbane 2 days before their cruise. They're brought to Gold Coast. They're given a land package. And then they go back and do their cruise. There's no investment required. There's no risk. And it's pure income. And it fits with the tourism product that already exists.
And common sense would seem to support that too.
Yeah.
As you say the words, to me it sounds perfectly logical and reasonable. Yeah. And I'm wondering why the council is even proposing this thing. I find it astonishing that they are.
Well, I think it's – you got to know the industry and know the pros and cons – or the way the industry thinks, but you also need to think creatively. And I think they've become wedded to we want a cruise terminal as opposed to the prior question of how can we benefit, how can we exploit cruise tourism to our benefit, and how can we do it in a way that doesn't require a huge investment. I mean, the other possibility, ships come into Brisbane, we'll spend the day there. I think it would be practical to offer a shore excursion which brings people from Brisbane by the water to Gold Coast and then takes them back by land. You've got another group that comes down to Gold Coast by land and goes back by water. The water trip from here to Brisbane would be wonderful, going through the estuaries. So it's kind of – I think it's a matter of thinking creatively of how can we, again, manifest business without having to invest huge sums of money at taxpayers' expense.
I agree. And it makes common sense, doesn't it?
Yes.
When you say that the council perhaps have become wedded to the idea – it may be the council has, but it certainly has that one person has become wedded to the idea, which I think is a difficulty in itself. But leaving that subject for a moment, do you intend to come back regularly to Australia?
Well, my pattern is to come regularly, and certainly if I had reason to come back, I certainly would. I have a regular kind of both travel budget and I have a regular pattern of travel, so if there was reason for me to be here, I certainly would. But there's other places of the world I'd like to spend time in as well. So if they pull me, I'm as likely to go there as opposed to here.
And as our time is growing short, one last question I'd like to canvass with you, and that is, I understand there are different segments in the cruise liner industry, and while I may and others may think of very large ships coming here, I might add too, longer than the Q1 tower is high.
Yes.
Which I think brings home just how big these ships are and how ridiculous it would be to try and bring them in the seaway. But that aside, just a comment about the other segments of the industry, if you would.
Yeah, well, I guess let me put in perspective. The largest ships afloat right now are over 6,000 passengers with crew, almost 10,000 people on board. It's huge. The smallest ships around, about 100 passengers. Within the cruise industry itself, you have segments between the mass market lines, which would be like P&O Australia, and you can get a P&O Australia ship for probably $60 or $70 a day. But there's also what would be called premium lines, Holland America, Princess, Celebrity, and there would be ultra-luxury lines, Silver Sea, Regent Seven Seas. The difference is here, and then there's niche cruises, expedition cruises, adventure cruises. The difference between these is that the per diem difference. So the P&O, I said, is $70 to $80 a day. When you go to the ultra-luxury or some of the niche cruises, you're paying $600 to $1,000 a day. The question I think that a port wants to ask is, which of those passengers do we want to attract? I'd much prefer to attract those higher per diem passengers because they're going to have a greater ability to spend money in my community than bringing in a bunch of people who are extending themselves to pay $60 a day and have no money left over to spend once they're ashore. So I think it's a matter of a conscious decision of what is the cruise or tourism product we want to establish and how do we target that segment of the industry in order to maximize the value of this for our efforts.
Look, time is short, as I said, and I'm very grateful for you coming in and speaking with us and our audience today, Ross, Professor Ross Klein, and to Steve Gratian, who's the president again, been re-elected, for Save Our Spit. You just nudged your way in again, Steve.
Yes, they were queuing up to take the job off me, I'm sure. No, all the committee positions were filled without having to go to an election or a vote. So I retained my presidency for a 13th year.
Excellent. Why do we do these things? I don't know. But I enjoy hearing the facts rather than the myths in anything. So thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.